The following show was recorded on the 7th of February 2012, and more information can be found about Ray Peet's work at raypeet.com. That's raypeat.com. Hello and welcome to Politics and Science. I'm your host, John Barkhausen, and this is part three of a discussion about progesterone and Dr. Raymond Peet's work with progesterone over the years. Dr. Peet, for those who don't know, has a PhD in biology from the University of Oregon and with a specialty in physiology and has done a lot of research in the fields of endocrinology and science history. So, Ray, welcome once again to Politics and Science.
Hi.
So in the last two shows, Ray, we covered some of the history of and your work with progesterone. This week, I'm hoping we'll be able to cover some of the politics and economic pressures affecting the science of progesterone. So to start this off, in spite of its proven anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory effects, progesterone is now deemed a carcinogenic substance under California's Proposition 65. So I guess my question is, how did this turn of events come to pass?
Yeah, the proposition says that you can sell carcinogens in any form that you want, but you just have to quote the law that says this is known by the state of California to cause cancer and or birth defects and such. But it isn't a law against selling carcinogens, just that you have to warn against them. And partly driven by lawyers who were given the opportunity to enforce the law instead of the state, lawyers could collect the fines themselves. They chose to interpret the law to mean that the presence of anything which could be carcinogenic in any other situation it makes a product require the warning, so that it ended up that parking lots had to be warned that they were carcinogenic. The public had to see a sign if they went into the parking lot.
What was the rationale for the parking lots, Ray?
It was either the paving material or the fact that there were cars there emitting exhaust fumes.
Oh, my God.
And chocolate producers were sued. Manufacturers of drinking glasses that had paint on the outside. Bread manufacturers, potato vendors, vegetables, anything that there was a whole wave of these insane prosecutions, and lawyers made a lot of money. And the real function of that law, besides enriching lawyers, it was to put the warnings everywhere in the produce department of grocery stores and on apartment buildings and on fishing tackle and hardware and so on, so that it became a joke. Everything was labeled a carcinogen, so the carcinogens became invisible. The real carcinogens were submerged in this phony warning business. And it was still legal to sell carcinogens, but since everything had the warning, the public basically wasn't warned against the real carcinogens. And physicians could prescribe the carcinogens as long as they were under a doctor's orders.
Huh. That's a brilliant strategy on the part of business, it sounds like.
Yeah, and very bad for the public.
Yeah.
And it had been brought to the attention of the Attorney General and so on. And the lawyers basically are in control of the government, so that anything that would impair their ability to shake down the public doesn't interest the law enforcement people. I gathered some evidence and asked the Attorney General if nonprofit corporations aren't supposed to take money from industries to destroy their competitors and such. And I gathered up evidence that made it look pretty clear that that was what was going on. And they said, if I can prove that they have committed a crime, they will investigate.
So if you do all the work...
then they would just investigate it and say they would prosecute it.
And I didn't quite follow. What does a nonprofit have to do with it?
The nonprofit organizations were being formed either as fronts for lawyers to extort money, or as I couldn't prove it because I couldn't subpoena the documents, but it, on its surface, it looks very much like the competing industries are using those organizations to get rid of progesterone, among other products.
Sure, that makes perfect sense. So they basically form kind of a cartel and go after their competitors. It's a very strange law where you, it sounds like the Wild West, where you just anybody can deputize themselves and go after somebody else to enforce that very open-ended law.
Yeah. And the state prescribes the type of penalty that they can get. I forget, it was like $50 for each drinking glass that was sold without a warning.
Wow.
It was a huge amount of money, millions of dollars that the lawyers have collected.
That's so Kafka-esque. And it sounds so ridiculous, but it actually has serious repercussions for somebody who's trying to sell a product that they think is helpful. For instance, what happens to you if you don't obtain the California seal of approval of not being a carcinogen?
If you don't have 10 employees or more, the law doesn't apply to you, so you legally shouldn't be able to sell anything without a warning, except the lawyers ignore that. They go ahead and extort money from people who just on the face of the law, it can't be applied to.
And do they threaten to pursue you in court if you don't pay them off, or do they actually...
Oh, yeah. Oh, they do. They threaten you, then they pursue you.
Uh-huh.
And they keep it going for years.
It's basically extortion, I guess.
Yeah. If you Google... Shakedown Lawyers California. You'll get some of the history of it.
Okay. I had no idea. Because in our state, I think it carries quite a bit of weight if you're listed as a carcinogen in the state of California.
The California lawyers were getting big money from foreign corporations, even outside the U.S., because they do business with California. And California has such a big economy that... they control the world.
Yeah. Okay, well, that sort of sets the context for the legal environment in California. And when did you become aware that progesterone was going to be coming under the sights of these guys?
I guess about 10 or 15 years ago, some of the manufacturers started labeling the progesterone itself, known by California to be a carcinogen.
So it was already a done deal when you first heard about it?
I think it was 1987 when the California review happened. I'm not sure of the date. When the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment is what California's board is called. They call it WEHA, mm-hmm. O-E-H-H-A. And they weren't willing to give me the names of the people who were their qualified experts by their definition who made those decisions. But the law requires them to either just automatically list it because World Health Organizations or National Toxicology Program list it. They could just defer to them. But in this case, they decided to have their board of qualified experts look at the relevant evidence, and out of thousands of publications on the issue of cancer and progesterone, they picked out about a dozen articles that they said was the relevant, decisive evidence. And of those, several of them weren't even progesterone. There were birth control pills and things that contained no progesterone at all. They listed them as the relevant evidence, but when I got them to send me copies, they weren't even about progesterone in several cases. And then the ones that did involve progesterone in the research, every one of them was totally incompetent as a toxicology or science or cancer research. They were clearly manipulated to get a case against progesterone, but they failed in every case. They had only one outside person testify during the meeting, Richard Edgren, and they asked him why he had chosen to testify, and he said, because progesterone isn't a carcinogen.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went over some of the studies and mentioned that one of the studies using non-progesterone chemicals had produced some tumors that weren't metastatic, he wasn't in that moment talking about progesterone, but the chairman of the committee heard him say metastatic, even though he had said they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And since the topic of the meeting was progesterone, even though Edgren wasn't talking about progesterone in that case, that was the basis for making the decision. Like, if the Marx Brothers couldn't have been sillier.
Yeah, or Kafka couldn't have been more surreal.
Yeah.
You said Richard Edgren, they asked him why he had chosen to testify. It sounds like he wasn't even going to be there, except that he was concerned with this.
Yeah, because he pointed out that if you call non-carcinogens carcinogens, then what's the public going to think about real carcinogens? If you're going to ruin the whole issue of public safety if you blur anti-carcinogens with carcinogens. And one of the studies that they listed as evidence proving that progesterone is a carcinogen, the article introduced itself by reference to some studies by Alexander Lipschutz, who had published many papers and a book describing the anti-tumor properties of progesterone.
Yeah.
And this article referenced that and said that they were checking up on Lipschutz's work. But Lipschutz, in his paper that they were referring to, had specified that progesterone given continuously prevents or even sometimes reverses cancer. And in this paper that the California considered evidence of carcinogenicity, they gave intermittent progesterone treatments, exactly what Lipschutz had said wouldn't prevent cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And they concluded it doesn't prevent cancer. That was all the paper consisted of, a bad reputation of Lipschutz's evidence that progesterone prevents cancer. And California presented this this strange non-refutation of progesterone as a cancer preventive as evidence that it causes cancer. Again, it's
yeah, it's bizarre, but very, very effective. It sounds like, you know, nobody's going to question it because they're the experts.
All that was there was the title. There were a panel of experts. It was probably the receptionist who looked up some titles that had cancer and progesterone in them.
And they just figured nobody's ever going to care or look into it.
Yeah.
And that's because there's no money behind making progesterone, as you pointed out in an earlier show, so that they're not really stepping on any big toes when they do this, except the people who are actually benefiting from the use of progesterone.
Yeah, and around the time that someone petitioned to take progesterone off the list, and that petition was rejected because the person in charge of responding to the petition mentioned a study that was done at the World Health Organization Cancer Research Agency as having shown that, progesterone was a carcinogen. So I looked that up, and the people at the World Health Organization said they didn't know of any such thing, but they looked carefully and finally found one with the same date that California had cited, and it wasn't about progesterone.
What was that about?
Synthetic progesterone.
Oh, I see.
And California had cited that one obscure article, not about progesterone, to refute the petition that had presented evidence that progesterone protects against cancer. But that was just a way of saying, no, don't bother us. At the point that I asked them who made the decisions that were decisive, even though the decisions violated their own regulations, the head of the agency said, we don't have the resources to answer your questions anymore.
Like, go away.
Yeah.
Please go away. You're bothering me. Yeah.
And around the same time, someone petitioned to remove saccharin from the list of carcinogens. And there's a lot of evidence that saccharin is a carcinogen. And California decided to remove it from their list on the basis that the reason it causes cancer of the bladder in rats is peculiar to rat bladders, and it's sort of a crystallization, and the concussion caused by falling crystals onto the wall of the bladder. Basically, that's what the argument consisted of. They had no evidence that it was the contact of crystals with the bladder, but they found a paper that said it does cause crystallization in the bladder.
Yeah.
But there are also articles that showed that human urine crystallizes in exactly the same way the rats did. So there was nothing special about the rat crystals.
Yeah.
It was just, again, the reaching as far as they could not to see the evidence. And so they took it off the list. Again, just as false in the other direction to take saccharin off the list because it's a big industry moneymaker.
Yeah. So it sounds like they're there to represent certain interests and basically be a filter for what becomes available to the public or not, based on those interests, not the public's interests.
Yeah, that's their public. The corporations are the only public they're concerned with.
Yeah, and I recall from your newsletters that some of the tests they cited against progesterone, some of them were progestins, as you said, and you explained last time that progestins actually have, many of them have opposite effects of progesterone. They're synthetic progesterone, and they don't. Are they considered synthetic? Is that the right term? Progestin?
Well, yeah, they're synthetic, but they're a different molecule, so they aren't progesterone at all.
Right, okay.
And the industry got the FDA to allow them to call them progestins, even though they are good contraceptives. They prevent gestation. But because there is a change in the lining of a rabbit uterus under their influence, it happens to coincide with the changes caused by progesterone, at least in one or two features. On the basis of that, they call a non-progestin a progestin. It's a contraceptive, but they can see one feature of overlap with progesterone. So that's the strength for calling them a progestin.
I see. And for those who didn't hear the first two parts of this talk about progesterone, Dr. Pete was telling us that many times progestins are prescribed. People think they're taking progesterone, but they're actually taking these different molecules named after progesterone, but actually do not have many of the benefits that progesterone does.
In 1970, when I was working on progesterone, occasionally someone would say, did you see the paper in some big science magazine that progesterone causes cancer? And at that time, they were actually putting it in the title, progesterone causes cancer, but they weren't working with progesterone. They were just, even the editors of science journals were letting them get away with calling things by false names. And by the early 70s, the science world had clarified their terminology enough so that they started consistently calling the other molecules progestins or progestogens. And so there has been much less scientific confusion about the terms, but medical doctors are still pretty well confused about the difference between the anti-progestational progestins and the real progesterone.
And consequently, the public's also very confused, because I know a lot of people who are taking estrogen with progestins, and they think they're getting both progesterone and estrogen. And
yeah, natural progesterone has to carry the warning that it can cause heart defects, because some of the things that are called progestins cause heart defects. And so something that has one property of progesterone gets to be called a progestin, and then anything toxic that molecule does gets laid over on real progesterone. And that prevents, for example, women with epilepsy are told to avoid progesterone during pregnancy because it'll cause heart defects, but actually the real progesterone has been reported to prevent almost all birth defects when it's used before pregnancy.
And as we talked about in the earlier shows, most of these rulings seem to be connected to the estrogen industry, which just one drug alone, we were talking about last week, Premarin, I think, was $2 billion in sales roughly before the World Health Initiative test became public and estrogen sales dropped. So Dr. Pete was saying last week that as estrogen sales dropped, progesterone sales were going up, and this alarmed the industry. And consequently, it seems like there's a move against progesterone.
And you can see it in some of the traditional centers of estrogen promoting research. They, around that time, turned against progesterone instead of concentrating on how good estrogen is. They're stretching to find something bad linked to progesterone.
That's very interesting. Who is sitting on these boards, Ray? Where do these people come from? Do you know any of them, or have heard of them?
I looked up everyone on the board, and
We're talking about the board that decided what was a carcinogen in California. Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of them were linked to the university that was doing the anti-progesterone research, and the leading anti-progesterone guy was Malcolm Pike, and he and one or two others formed a company to promote a birth control pill based on his idea of protecting against progesterone. And the state of California was using federal grants and other funding to support corporations, his included. So government money was flowing into his anti-progesterone business while he was sitting influential in saying that progesterone is a carcinogen. And everyone I looked up on the board was either directly or indirectly concerned with something competing. For example, one of the people was on the board of a company promoting transdermal medical treatments, things that will administer drugs through the skin, while most of the progesterone products were being delivered through the skin. This person was representing a company that would probably be in line to market a medical progesterone transdermal.
I see. And what universities were they working for? And what were their fields of expertise? Are they physiologists? Do you know?
There was only one biologist on the committee and several toxicologists. University of Southern California has, I think, the biggest concentration of anti-progesterone work. I looked at the USC website about 5-6 years ago, and I found easily, I think it was 140 references to the glorious properties of estrogen, and I found, I forget, numerous, but not a competitive number, numerous references to progesterone, but every one of them was about its harmful properties. And if you look at them objectively, you have to look hard to find an objectively beneficial effect of estrogen, and you have to stretch very hard to find a harmful effect of progesterone.
Is the contents of this library because they've culled it, or they've just always cultivated articles with the right attitude as far as they're concerned?
The things on their website were research projects in progress.
Oh, I
think
you.
They were all in progress.
Right, so they're being funded through the university, probably from pharmaceutical research companies?
Yeah.
So that's basically, that university has come down on the side of the pharmaceutical companies that are funding them, in short.
Yeah, there are several labs around the country. Berkeley has more recently moved in that direction. Michigan was a big center of estrogen research, and some of those people moved to UC Berkeley, and interestingly, the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory is involved in anti-progesterone research, which seems to have grown out of the chemical warfare line of thinking.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a weapons lab, basically. And why are they interested in estrogen research or anti-progesterone research, do you think?
Well, it obviously would be for benign and harmless purposes.
I'm sure. Yeah. Are they affiliated with businesses? Do you know, Ray? I don't know anything about the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory.
I think it's all government money.
Well, one of the things you've written about Elwood Jensen, who's the supposed inventor of the concept of the receptor protein, the hormone receptor, is that right? He invented that concept?
Yeah. There were, the idea of receptors in general was being discussed in various fields, but for estrogen, the enzymologists were progressing very quickly in understanding the effects of estrogen and molecules like estrogen through the 1940s into the 1950s. And one of the lines of very productive research was showing that use and change estrogen back and forth between estrone and estradiol. Estrone is relatively inactive. Estradiol is very active. And that was classified as enzymology. And Jensen's argument was that if estrogen acts by activating a genetic program, and so it's only a female acting substance, because females are genetically determined to be female, and so what estrogen does is act on a receptor that activates a genetic program. And if something is acted on by enzymes, men have enzymes that are going to do the same reactions, and enzymology tended to generalize the estrogen issue and make it a masculine problem as well as female. Mm-hmm. But Jensen got the only support from the Atomic Energy Commission, which controlled the isotopes needed to do enzyme studies. And he used an isotope labeled form of estrogen, and in his experiments with uterus tissue claimed to show that there was no oxidation or reduction of estrogen by the uterus, and said that's the end of the enzyme tradition. It's all receptor and genes now. And that spread through the research world, and by the mid-1960s was the dogma. But then the enzymologist started getting the same isotopes that he had had, and showed that, in fact, the old 1940s research was exactly what's happening. And now everyone knows that estrogen, estradiol, and estrone are perfectly interchangeable. And that's exactly where progesterone and thyroid and the stress hormones interact with estrogen. Progesterone turns off some of the enzymes that activate estrogen, and activate enzymes that inactivate estrogen. So the enzyme approach opens up the whole issue of environmental, physiology, nutritional, metabolic effects on the estrogen system, and estrogen's deranging effects on all of those systems. So that's all now coming back, but 50 years of belief in a genetic explanation of why estrogen is so good for females and harmless to everyone else.
Yeah, I had trouble.
You got too fuzzy on that last sentence. I couldn't understand it.
Yeah, I was saying that Elwood Jensen, the reason I brought him up is because you mentioned Livermore Labs, and he worked in the chemical weapons industry. Isn't that right?
University of Chicago, I think is where he was working, and that was a big weapons laboratory. The government doesn't say much about their chemical biological warfare research, but if you look at the careers of some of the famous biologists, you see that they're... You can't explain their achievements other than that they were being pushed by the Pentagon to get the information that they needed for germ or chemical warfare.
So just to put a political context on Elwood Jensen's work and relate that to science, you're saying that the fact that he was able to shift the damage that estrogen does to the genetic causes, that sort of removed the liability of government pollution and industry pollution away from them to basically random genetic problems.
Yeah, until just, I guess, about 25 years ago, biologists thought about estrogen, working on the estrogen receptor, as simply activating femaleness in genetic females, and that therefore it would act only on a uterus or a female breast or the female pituitary, as if a man didn't share practically all enzymes and genes with women. It was just an extreme case of genetic cleaning up of the dangerous possibilities.
And the actual reality of how things work.
Yeah, estrogen has been known for about 30 or 40 years to act on every kind of tissue. You can find the estrogen receptor everywhere, but even without the estrogen receptor, you can demonstrate that it works on any kind of tissue. And some of the estrogenic compounds attached to the so-called estrogen receptor, but some have estrogenic effects without touching the estrogen receptor. So really, it should have a new name. It's the sometime estrogen receptor activator system, but it isn't really the crucial thing, because you can get estrogenic effects from radiation or cyanide or suffocation or various stresses and infections and so on. They'll all bring on estrus and swelling of cells and activation of the uterus and so on.
Inflammation.
And the overlap of stress and radiation and industrial smoke and so on with estrogen, that's one of the things that has been carefully avoided, and the receptor idea is crucial in covering that up.
Yeah, it sounds like what he came up with was a very sort of smoke and mirrors cartoon for selling a concept of how everything works in such a way that it fit in with the popular idea of the gene being how life is directed. And people may be wondering why we're talking about estrogen when this is a show about progesterone. And
well, estrogen in the physiological situation activates the production of progesterone, and then progesterone knocks down the production of estrogen. So it's a matter of an occasional stimulus from stress or estrogen, which turns on a system that then definitively gets rid of estrogen and leaves things operating for the rest of the month. And it's only the exaggerated, prolonged effect of estrogen that becomes a danger, and progesterone is the basic thing for getting rid of estrogen. And if you look at the enzymes involved, progesterone inactivates the aromatase enzyme that produces estrogen from the androgens, and it activates the two types of detoxifying enzymes, the glucuronide transferase and the sulfur transferase that attach sulfuric acid to make it water-soluble. And estrogen opposes those, and progesterone inactivates the estrogen-activated enzymes that remove the detoxified sulfate and glucuronide. So it's just an amazingly comprehensive system that progesterone does, and only real progesterone does that so systematically. It knocks out the production and maintenance and activation of estrogen, and it even destroys the so-called estrogen receptor protein. So at the action end, the production end, and all of the intermediate steps, progesterone systematically destroys the estrogen system. And that's one of the reasons that progesterone is so universally important. But it's the opposite side of why estrogen is so universally dangerous. Mm-hmm. Progesterone even protects against radiation as part of that same system, because radiation imitates estrogen, and the cancers produced by either radiation or estrogen, these are equally protected against by progesterone. So it's a comprehensive protective substance against the full range of biological threats.
And Elwood Jensen, the inventor of the estrogen receptor, that concept, and he goes on to talk about his work. It was apparent to him that very small amounts of estrogen caused cancer, and that was his challenge, is to figure out why that was. And he went on to try to discover other chemicals that opposed estrogen, and he came up with tamoxifen. I think everybody knows that has a lot of bad side effects.
A man named Dan Lednesser gives a more insider view of where tamoxifen came from. And the people who were working on the fact that estrogen is like the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, mm-hmm. in causing not only cancer, but inflammation and fibrosis. They were looking for anti-inflammatory things because polycyclic hydrocarbons and estrogen create inflammation, and looking for anti-inflammatory things, they accidentally found that tamoxifen was anti-estrogen as well. And out of that line of research, according to Dan Lednesser, even Celebrex, the COX-2 mm-hmm. inhibiting NSAIDs, even these derived from that line of research that was thinking about a more basic view of what estrogen does.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The receptor wasn't involved at all in that kind of thinking.
Okay. Well, maybe I could be misquoting Elwood Jensen, but it sounded like he was involved in something to do with tamoxifen. But the thing I didn't understand was it's been known for a long time that progesterone does oppose estrogen and does it so completely, as you've pointed out. And so why were they even bothering to look for something else? That's what puzzled me.
I think you have to imagine the mentality of the person he said suggested the looking for how the estrogen affects the tissues was Charles Huggins. He founded the lab that Jensen was working in, and according to Jensen, he gave him the idea, but I think you have to see what flakes they were, even though it was the University of Chicago. They were just totally unaware of the world of biochemistry as related to cancer. I don't really know how it was possible. You'd have to have a detailed biography of how what courses they were teaching and so on. But Huggins is the guy that theorized that he read a textbook in which they made the rooster grow its comb by giving it testosterone and the classical things. And so they said, since testosterone makes a man develop a prostate gland and estrogen makes women develop breasts, if you want to stop the growth of cancer in the breast, you will either remove estrogen or give testosterone. That was his first suggestion, I think. And for the prostate, you would either castrate the man or give the man estrogen or both, because his simple idea was that the female and male were opposites. And so if you give the opposite hormone, you'll antagonize the growth-promoting effect of their hormone. Basically, a completely idiotic idea at the time he proposed it, but no one was there to tell him so. That immediately started doctors all over the country castrating men by the millions. And for, I guess, 45, 50 years, they were giving men estrogen with or without castration to treat prostate cancer, all on that very ignorant early 20th century idea of opposition of the hormones.
I had no idea that that went on, the castration.
Huggins was the one who, besides proposing castrating men to cure prostate cancer and giving them estrogen, he first proposed removing the ovaries to stop the estrogenic stimulation. And then, since some of them didn't recover from that, he took out their adrenal glands as another source of estrogen. And that was practiced up right through the 60s, I think, until about 1970. And at one point, Huggins even proposed treating breast cancer with estrogen. It didn't make any sense, but he had sort of a Frankenstein mentality. Let's tinker with things and maybe we'll come up with something.
And he saw everything in just black and white.
Yeah, and that's the mentality that Jensen was working with. And he, you know, I think it involved basically either incredibly bad science or deliberate fraud for him to say that estrogen absolutely wasn't being metabolized in the tissues where it was having an effect.
Mm.
And that was his proof of that it acted only through the receptor.
Well, that's reminds me of H.L. Mencken's saying that for every complex problem, there's a simple, concise answer that's absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
And perhaps we only have about 10 minutes left, I believe. It would be good for people to hear about how progesterone does work in combating cancer. I don't think we've actually talked too much about that. Mostly we've talked about its anti-inflammatory effects, but and maybe you could cite some of the uses it's actually had with success.
Alexander Lipschutz was the person who did the most comprehensive work showing that where estrogen causes fibrosis, fibroids first and eventually cancer, it acts first on the uterus, then on the breasts, then on the lungs, kidneys, brain, and it's just a matter of where estrogen concentrates that it tends to cause fibromas and cancers. And in every one of those situations, progesterone was protective, and now it's known that it has this about, I think, 9 different mechanisms by which it eliminates the estrogen problem. So the cause and effect outcome was defined by 1950 by Alexander Lipschutz, and then the more detailed stuff is still being developed. An Italian has done some very good work looking at the range of things progesterone does defensively. Someone named Mendelssohn has done a lot of work on the protective effects of progesterone against estrogen. But the full reason of why progesterone is is protective against cancer, you have to look at the whole spectrum of what estrogen is doing. The first thing estrogen does is cause the cell to take up water, and taking up water stimulates cell division and fat production and a lot of other enzyme activities. These effects happen within minutes of the time of estrogen exposure, and so anyone looking at simple tissue biological experiments way back 80 years, as soon as they had a concentrated estrogen-like material, they could see that it instantaneously was causing the tissue to take up water and begin producing fats and other substances and to divide. So it takes at least several hours for genes to get activated and cause cellular changes. So obviously the receptor wasn't involved in those instantaneous effects of estrogen. And those are exactly what the essence of the cancer problem is. If you start an inflammation that causes cells to keep taking up water, in that stressed condition of activating cell chemistry, they're using energy faster, and the stimulation of cell division is tending to use up the supply of oxygen and sugar. In my thesis research, one of the things I did was show that adding estrogen to a system such as the uterus lowers the oxygen tension. It just sucks the oxygen out of the system, and so it kills the embryo that's trying to implant if there's a little too much estrogen or not enough progesterone. So that stimulation creates an oxygen deficiency, and as far as sugar is available, the sugar will be glycolyzed to produce emergency energy in the absence of enough oxygen to meet the stimulation. The glycolysis produces lactic acid. The production of lactic acid leaving the cell raises the pH inside the cell, and that increased pH keeps the swelling going on, activates cell division and expensive energy. So it needs something from the outside to stop the production of lactic acid and deliver oxygen and so on. Progesterone is one of the essential things for stopping that process. But once it starts under the influence of estrogen, you get the lactic acid production, which creates the vicious cycle of cell activation. And the lactic acid acts as it increases the supply of blood and spreads growth of blood vessels into the environment. So it activates everything that you need to produce a tumor. And all that's needed is the absence of an anti-inflammatory energy-restoring substance such as aspirin or progesterone to stop this process. If you don't have those available, the lactic acid stimulates surrounding cells to change their physiology in ways that you have a progressive increase of the malignancy behavior of the cells. In the simplest situation, an injury causes the lactic acid to be produced, which activates the energy changes and growth to heal the wound. But at a certain point, the system should come in with the anti-inflammatory substances, such as progesterone, to finish off the healing. And in the absence, the healing attempt at healing simply goes on and creates this swelling and oxygen-deficient situation. And if you grow cells in a culture dish and deprive them of oxygen just by having them in a dish without good circulation, they will eventually mutate and form other types of cell that cause a derangement and alteration of the tissue type. So all of the steps of cancerization can be seen structurally and metabolically in terms of wound healing that can't be brought to completion.
Oh, yeah, that's good. I like that. And I think Harry Rubin, you've pointed out, has basically proven that it's that cancer is not from a gene gone bad, but rather the tissue itself has developed an unhealthy state. We have a couple minutes, if you could maybe cover that briefly.
He has just honestly summarized the real cancer research, showing that the deranged metabolism and structure is what causes the chromosomal damage. So the instead of genes causing the tumor causes the genetic defects.
Which is the opposite of what we hear basically every day in our popular culture when people talk about cancers.
Yeah, and when an oncologist or pathologist says your tissue shows abnormal cell division and the wrong number of chromosomes and such, they said that means we have to cut it out and irradiate you and so on. But if you look at the fate of those deranged cells, they're going to live maybe to the next attempt to divide. Then they don't have the right number of chromosomes, and the halves will die. So they're very short-lived once they get to that deranged state. But the death of the cell contributes to the inflammation of the area. And so stopping the inflammation and energy deficit is always the solution to the problem. When it's now recognized by some oncologists that the reason a malignant cancer reforms after they've irradiated the area or cut out the cancer or both, the reason it reforms is that stem cells are called into the inflamed area that has been treated. And even if you irradiate a healthy area, it will call stem cells in to try to repair the wound. And if the radiation deranged the fibrous material in that area, you'll produce a cancer from the irradiation. So whenever you injure a tissue by removing a tumor, you're just guaranteeing that the body will try to repair the wound by sending in new cells, which then turn into cancer cells if the area is still sick.
Yeah. So the way to actually heal or to stay healthy is to make sure that your cellular environment is a healthy one.
Yeah.
So for anti-inflammatory substances that people can use, progesterone is one of them, and aspirin is another. And
antihistamines. Okay. Going way back 50 years, people were seeing that antihistamines would occasionally cure cancer, but that just didn't catch on in the profession. Aspirin, 10 or 15 years ago, when I would mention it to someone with cancer, they would think I was, you know, like the doctor saying, take an aspirin and call me later.
Call me from the next life. but you're saying that progesterone and aspirin are actually viable cancer treatments.
And some of the antihistamines are definitely protective.
All right. Well, if people want to read more about this, they can find out lots of Ray Peet's ideas at raypeet.com. That's raypeat.com, where I think, Ray, you said you had 70 articles up there or so.
I'll be putting about a dozen more up in a couple of weeks, I think.
That's great. It's a beautiful website, by the way. I love the sombrero and the ice cream cone.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. And we have been talking to Dr. Raymond Peet, who's has a PhD in biology from the University of Oregon and with speciality in physiology, and also has done extensive research in endocrinology and science history. And as always, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Ray. Thanks so much for coming on.
Okay, thank you.
That wraps it up for Politics and Science this week. Please tune in again next week for another edition of Politics and Science. Podcasts can be found at radioforall.net.